This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terrorists have been adapting new tactics, and the American government is trying to figure out how to react. The Clinton administration is restructuring its plan for responding to terrorist attacks involving chemical or biological weapons. My guest, Bruce Hoffman, has written a new book about past and present trends in terrorism and what those trends say about why terrorists do what they do. His new book is called Inside Terrorism. He directs the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and he's about to take on his new position as director of the RAND Corporation's Washington office, where he will focus on terrorism research. Hoffman says that the Irgun, the Jewish group that revolted against British rule in Palestine, established a revolutionary model which was emulated by terrorist groups around the world. The Irgun was commanded by Menachem Begin, who later became the Prime Minister of Israel. I asked Hoffman about the new and effective tactics the group used.
Begin was very savvy in an era long before CNN and long before global media as we know it now in its most immediate daily form. He realized that the most effective way to get the British out of Palestine wasn't necessarily to beat them on the battlefield, but to beat them, let's say, in the war of propaganda, and to appeal not to an audience, as previous acts of violence, revolutionary violence, had been done, to an audience within your own country to rise up. So his strategy was to appeal to world opinion, and particularly to take the struggle, at least psychologically, outside of Palestine, back to London, back to the British voter, but I think pivotally, also to New York and to the nascent United Nations organization, and to bring international pressure to bear on Britain by, in Begin's words, turning Palestine into a glass house that no one could, you know, ignore looking at, but at the same time, everybody was looking into, and thus putting pressure on the British to leave.
And you think that became a model for other terrorist groups?
Yes, I think certainly the most successful terrorist groups of the 1950s, let's say the first generation of post-war anti-colonialist groups, those organizations that similarly sought to appeal to international opinion were more effective. And by this, I'm thinking of the FLN in Algeria, who in their revolt against French rule choreographed or orchestrated their biggest acts of violence to coincide with the opening of the United Nations General Assembly, for example. Just like the Irgun, sending this direct message to diplomats. And we see then in the 1960s, really the archetypal exponents of this successful approach, the Palestinians. Now, not just using violence in their own country and focusing attention in that, but taking the struggle outside even the region of conflict, deliberately involving other citizens from other nations, and therefore creating this environment that no one can ignore their cause.
Let's get to the PLO. You say that the PLO invented modern international terrorism on July 22, 1968, with the hijacking of the Israeli El Al commercial flight from Rome to Tel Aviv. Just describe the act again and what happened.
Sure. Well, certainly there was nothing new about airline hijackings. In fact, the first one was perpetrated, I believe, in the 1930s. And certainly during the 1960s, there were any number of, for instance, homesick Cuban nationals hijacking American planes and going to return to Cuba, essentially. What separated the PLO's action, actually it was the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the constituent members commanded by George Habash. What set this apart from those terrorist acts is that the motive was undeniably political. They were specifically targeting a symbol of sovereignty, of nationality. El Al is the Israeli national carrier. Also, too, I think they were using that airliner and its passengers as a form of traveling theater. In other words, they were creating a media event that was impossible to ignore, and that they could, like turning on and off a faucet of water, they could, you know, increase the pressure by landing it dramatically in a foreign capital, issuing demands, then taking off again, landing again in another capital, issuing more demands. So it was a way to constantly apply pressure on governments. And I think this sent a powerful message to many similarly aggrieved minorities, ethnic nationalist groups throughout the world who saw that through terrorism, they too could thrust hitherto ignored, disparaged causes and thrust those causes onto the world's agenda through a series of very well-timed and well-orchestrated acts of violence.
Another turning point that you mentioned in the history of modern terrorism is the attack at the Munich Olympics. Describe what happened then.
Well, there really what the...
This was 1972.
Right, it was September 1972. And what the terrorists did was, in essence, hijack the worldwide media that, of course, had descended on Munich to cover the Olympic Games, and to hijack that and to focus their attention, to wrest the world's attention from the sporting event to, on the one hand, the plight of these Israeli athletes, the 11 Israeli athletes that had been seized, but also, just as effectively, to focus worldwide attention on the Palestinians' plight. And I think one could quite persuasively argue that there were, whoever was ignorant of the Palestinians, of their cause, of their travails, of their, you know, refugee status, were far less ignorant in the days after the Munich Olympics, because now everyone knew about the Palestinians and knew about their plight.
Okay, so you just mentioned two major PLO terrorist actions that helped to bring their plight, you know, to the attention of the world. So then the world gets really familiar with the PLO, but the actions continue. At that point, what meaning do the actions have?
Well, the actions continue in the sense that the PLO, I think, spawned a lot of imitators, because no matter what governments say, they always say terrorism doesn't work, but many groups, not just the PLO, the Irgun, AOKA, the FLN, showed that terrorism does work, and it can be actually very effective, because why would anyone pay attention to these peoples and their causes if they weren't using violence? So I think the PLO spawned a whole raft of imitators or successors, but then you had a problem of an increasing number of terrorist groups competing for what one might describe as a diminishing audience share. In other words, terrorism wasn't quite the big news that it once was when the PLO burst on the scene with airline hijackings. You had even a very small dissident group, the South Moluccans in the Netherlands, for example, seizing a train. Again, following on this, they couldn't get on an airplane, so they seized a train instead. But following on this idea of seizing civilians and turning them into this traveling theater analogy I use. So the trouble is you have them more groups competing for attention that's becoming more used to terrorism. So I think tragically and unfortunately, in a pattern we still see today, that the answer for many of these groups is just to kill more and destroy more in order to get the same amount of attention that a far more discreet terrorist act might have gotten 10 or 15 years ago.
The major thing that you see happening now is the coming together of religious extremism and terrorism. What are the most recent examples of that that you would offer?
Well, I think the clearest, most recent example would be the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, where the motive, of course, is political, because terrorism itself, I think, has to be political. That's what separates it from other forms of violence that don't have this political motive. What's new is that there's now a religious justification or legitimization for the violence, that it's done not only as a way to influence people and to gain power to change mankind or to change international politics in a certain way, but it's being justified not on the basis of abstract ideologies, as was the case, let's say, during the Cold War, or even by ethno-nationalist justifications. But now, I mean, in essence, that they feel a divine mandate, that God is commanding them to carry out this violence to fulfill some sacred objective.
And what problems does that pose for a government that is being asked to respond to the terrorists?
Well, we see in Northern Ireland how there's the potential to solve a longstanding violent situation like that through negotiations, through political concession, through autonomy, power sharing, I think very standard political remedies. To a holy terrorist who has a fundamentally different worldview, who feels, I think, very aggrieved and very much cast on the defensive. I mean, that's the other point, too, is that we tend to look at terrorists, particularly religious terrorists, as mindless fanatics. I think far from that. They actually have an inner logic, and they're also, to a certain extent, they see themselves as reluctant warriors. But how do you approach that person? What concession do you give to someone who believes they're committing violence to better serve God or to fulfill some divine mandate? I mean, it's hard to see how amnesties, economic incentives, for example, or some devolved form of autonomy or power sharing is going to satisfy those types of aims.
Well, let's take the bombings of embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. What do you think we ought to understand about the terrorists and their motivations?
Well,
not that they've taken credit for it.
No, well,
that's part of the problem, isn't it? I mean, how can you respond at all if you don't even know who's responsible?
Well, I think that's hitting the nail on the head. I think terrorism has always been a very difficult, if not intractable, problem. But the bad news is it's become even more difficult, because now you have a situation where terrorists don't claim credit. In the past, for example, the groups such as the traditional stereotypical terrorist organizations, like the various Palestinian groups, like the IRA, like the Basque separatist group, ETA, for example, the Red Army faction in Germany, would claim credit for what they did. And not only would they claim credit, but they would often in very turgid and overwrought prose, but explain to us exactly why they did it. So that also made our response, when we could fashion a response, somewhat easier, because we knew how to address their problems. So I think the fundamental challenge with the East African bombings is first trying to divine what the terrorists want. I mean, it's a very different phenomenon now in that there hasn't been a credible claim issued. And the only sort of information one has are very vague and hazy demands that the United States withdraw all Crusader or infidel forces from what they see as the Holy Land. In other words, Mecca and Medina, Saudi Arabia, that is. You get to a position where, do you want a terrorist group, or even if this Osama bin Laden is obviously the person behind it, do you want one man dictating to a country what its foreign policy should be? But I think nonetheless, though, one has to understand that there's tremendous enmity now directed against the United States from certain parts of the world, and that obviously part of at least making progress against the problem is addressing the reasons and understanding the reasons why there is this enmity and working to ways to counter it.
My guest is Bruce Hoffman, author of the new book Inside Terrorism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Hoffman. He's the author of the new book, Inside Terrorism. He is also the new director of the Washington office of the RAND Corporation, where he'll be focusing on terrorism research. One of the things we're seeing now, which has everybody very worried, is the coming together of religiously motivated terrorism with weapons of mass destruction. I mean, a good example would be the Aum Shinrikyo use of sarin gas in Japan. You say in your book that it used to be assumed that terrorists weren't going to use weapons of mass destruction. Why did anyone assume that?
Well, there was an adage that Brian Jenkins, who's really one of the founders of terrorism studies, had coined in the 1970s that at the time was quite accurate, that terrorists wanted a lot of people watching and a lot of people listening and not a lot of people dead. In other words, there was this assumption on the part of terrorists that they could kill small numbers but do so dramatically and get a lot of attention, whereas they risked, if they killed a lot of people, alienating precisely the same people of whom they wanted attention for. They weren't going to influence the world, let's say, to take their plight seriously if they killed a lot of people and therefore alienated any sympathy. That, I think, began to change with the advent of religious terrorism because the mechanisms or the means of justification and legitimization were very different. You didn't have people necessarily seeking to influence or to mold opinion as much as to serve their particular deity or their particular god, and therefore wrap their violence in this justification that, I mean, if God knows I did it, that's fine. I don't have to publicize. I don't have to claim credit. And this, in turn, I think, has led to a built-in escalatory spiral, at least the potential for a built-in escalatory spiral, because many of these religious groups, because of their profound alienation, see the world in terms of us against them. And therefore, if you're not a member of their particular group, and this is why the nomenclature that religious terrorists use, all religious terrorists, is so fascinating. Their enemies are never spoken of in human terms. They're always dehumanized and called infidels, mud people, dogs, curs, things like that, that they feel they're unworthy of life, that God has anointed them as God's messengers, that is the terrorists, and that all these other people are nothing, so that to kill them, there's just very little restraint. I mean, to kill them is justified with religious liturgy and sanctioned by clerics. I mean, this is why in many of these groups, not just Islamic ones, they don't operate unless a religious figure blesses their act of violence. So this then, for them, justifies almost widespread open-ended violence against anyone who's not a member of their religious sect.
Do you think of the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City and the bombing of the World Trade Center as being both an example of religious groups using weapons of mass destruction?
No. I think, perhaps somewhat controversially, that both were religiously motivated. I think the World Trade Center, many people would agree with me that there was certainly a group of people brought together who were Muslims who were opposed United States, support of Israel and various other Middle Eastern governments, and who, you know, were motivated, at least to come together, certainly through a common place of worship and a common belief system. Oklahoma City, I think that McVeigh very much traveled in white supremacist circles that not only were seditious and anti-federalist and also opposed to gun control, but also that very much believed in the Christian identity credo, which is really the thread, I think, that connects white supremacism in America together now. And it is very much of a religious movement. I mean, when McVeigh himself admitted that he was a Christian patriot, I think the import of that wasn't quite understood when it was reported that they thought, well, he's Christian, he's patriotic. But rather that refers to a specific belief system that incorporates the identity church and identity doctrine. So yes, I think it's religion. Weapons of mass destruction, no, because I think when we talk about weapon of mass destruction, we're really talking about the nuclear, biological, or chemical weapon that have the potential to kill in the thousands. I mean, it was tragic that 168 people perished in Oklahoma City, and certainly several hundred were injured, that 12 people died at the World Trade Center, and 5,000 were injured. But we're still talking about two conventional weapons. I mean, bombs, they were big bombs, and the bombs were designed to have a very profound effect to bring down two buildings. But it's still not, I think, technically what we really should call a weapon of mass destruction.
Do you think we should be preparing for terrorist attacks with weapons of mass destruction that will kill large numbers of people, nuclear, chemical, biological weapons?
Well, I think it's a genuine threat. The question is, it's a threat that's probably has low likelihood, but potentially astronomical consequences, both immediate and physical and psychological. And I think the challenge for any government is to steer that middle course between reacting prudently to a threat that's not that likely, but that will have enormous consequences.
My guest is Bruce Hoffman. He's the author of the new book, Inside Terrorism, and he's the new director of the Washington office of the RAND Corporation, where he will be focusing on terrorism research. There's a peace agreement in effect in Northern Ireland now. Looking back over the IRA's many years of terrorist actions, what would you say the IRA's legacy is now in the history of terrorism and its effectiveness?
I think quite simply that terrorism works. I think the IRA has shown through its persistence, certainly, that Irish nationalism was a force that had to be reckoned with, that couldn't be pushed aside, that had to be addressed. And then I think very much in recent years, particularly since the breakdown of the ceasefire and the initial ceasefire in 1996, they demonstrated quite clearly, again, this analogy of turning on the tap of violence, how pressure can be brought to bear against a government by disrupting all traffic going into London, for example, by plotting to blow up the electrical power supply that feeds into London, by threatening to blow up bridges, that violence can be a very effective lever in animating governments to come back to the negotiating table, even though they may have pledged that we wouldn't negotiate with those men of violence. So I think it's shown once again that terrorism works.
But it took a really long time for that peace agreement to be in place.
It has, and I shouldn't be completely cynical or pessimistic. I think that what's happened in Northern Ireland, I think, defies even the most pessimistic observers. But I think it's worked that way because it has less in some respects to do with what the IRA has done than the Irish people, and having been there several times myself. I mean, there is such a groundswell and feeling of the Irish people that they've had enough of this, that it's become powerful enough that the men of violence in both the nationalist and the unionist communities couldn't ignore it, that they had to respond to it. So I don't think we should give all that much credit to the sort of, you know, newfound peacefulness of either, the Irish Republicans or Irish loyalists in Northern Ireland. I think a lot of the credit really goes to the people in Northern Ireland.
When you say terrorism works, do you mean that terrorism works when the terrorist group has a real legitimate political point that it's trying to make, or do you mean that just any prolonged amount of violence against a power is eventually going to be effective?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one has to make a differentiation. I think on one level, terrorism works when it attracts attention to a particular group and to its cause that might not have been attracted had they not resorted to violence. Whether they can parlay or whether they can turn that attention into political leverage, I think involves the skills of people who have proven themselves to be either visionaries or statesmen. I mean, Menachem Begin would have to be one of those people too, but certainly Yasser Arafat, Jerry Adams today. So I think we have to be careful. I mean, it works. It certainly does provide attention on, as I said, hitherto ignored or rejected causes. It works less well and less consistency in actually bringing power or the fruition of a particular group's aims. But I think if used properly and applied strategically, it can bring to many aggrieved peoples the benefits that governments say terrorism doesn't bring to them.
I'm wondering, you know, from what you've seen of times when the terrorist group actually wins in the long run, what they do with the victory, you know?
Well, I think they find that it's easier to be a terrorist organization than it is actually to be a governing body. I think terrorist organizations are enormously innovative, enormously organizationally resilient in the sense that they're small, so they're not large bureaucracies. You have people who, revolution is the vocation, that's what they're all about, so that they're susceptible to change and they're willing to adjust and adapt. They often have to make do with very limited means and in resources. And I think they find once that they're in power that it's entirely different, that firstly they have constituents now that they have to directly answer to, not only whom in the past they could have purported to represent. They find that the issues of day-to-day governance are not nearly as romantic, or you know, that this idea of changing the world, now you've just got to achieve something like open up the sewage lines, for example, or send children to school. So I think that they find often in power, it's different than being in the terrorist organization when they come to power. And I think also, too, that they find that they're very intolerant of dissent, and that often they suppress any attempt to either not just roll back the revolution, but to redefine the revolution in ways that their particular organization no longer thinks are appropriate. So you find this problem, as we see, you know, the Palestine Authority of, you know, accusation of themselves being repressive towards the Palestinian people. So I think it's enormously difficult when they do come to power.
Well, Bruce Hoffman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bruce Hoffman is the author of Inside Terrorism. He's the new director of the Rand Corporation's Washington office. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.